Well, welcome to the Jung Association of Western Massachusetts monthly lecture. And we have Jason Smith returning. I have a few announcements, but I'm thrilled he came back. And I think you're in for a wonderful afternoon. I'm Penny Tarasuk, Penelope Tarasuk. I'm on the board. And Erica, who normally does these introductions, is on some sunny island without us. So the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to thank the board. I wanted to thank Dan especially for all the work you do in technology, advertising, you know, the works. Thank you, Dan. And Carol, thank you so much. Carol Bouvet, you did so much in our community connection. And Eldrick, who's newer to the board, but we got him working on it. Thank you very much. And let's see, Chris Olson, where are you? Anyway, Chris Olson.
She's minding the board.
She's so good. And of course, Thayer is in the sunshine in Florida with Newtown, resting. And Chuck, I don't know if Chuck's here tonight, but Chuck's done some wonderful volunteer work for us. There's one more person who I haven't met, Diane Allen? Where is she?
Yeah.
I have to talk to you, but I understand you're doing some wonderful stuff for us for Facebook.
Yeah, I'm having it on the page.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So it really takes a community to put together programs like this. It takes volunteers. It takes time and energy. And I'm very happy that we have a very functioning group and we can support people like Jason coming. So I am appreciative of our community and you. Without you coming to hear this stuff, we wouldn't have anybody to talk to. So thank you for coming. And I'm appreciative for Smith College and the use of the facilities. And there was, we have a technology person. What is your name again?
Rachel.
Rachel, thank you for coming and helping us, Rachel. I appreciate the realm of technology and the deity of Hermes. Hermes Mercury is moving through technology, I'm quite sure. We had hoped to have this video today, but that's not going to happen, but it will be audio recorded, and it will be eventually posted on our website. There'll be a mosaic cafe later after the talk, a little restaurant for tea or Middle Eastern food over on, is it Center Street?
Masonic
Street, right. So you can walk over there after the talk and meet and greet and discuss the lecture, whatever. Let's see, the next program is Friday, February 2nd, 7 to 9 p.m. Erica Lorenz is going to talk on healing through the imaginal realm. And please take brochures and distribute them in your community if you can. And if you want to sign up sheet for being for us to communicate with you about events. We should post snow cancellation online if the program is going to be postponed. And I wanted to say my book, Polishing the Bones, is now here. And I brought a few, so during the break or afterwards, come and see me. And now, Jason Smith is a Jungian analyst in private practice in Manchester-by-the-Sea, the North Shore of Massachusetts. His areas of focus include dream work, midlife transitions, and spiritual development. He's a graduate of Pacifica Graduate Institute and the C.G. Jung Institute of Boston, where he is currently serving as president of the training board. So that is quite an accomplishment and a big job. Thank you, Jason. I've known Jason through the C.G. Jung Institute Boston for, I think, over 10 years. And I've witnessed and enjoyed his depth of thought and heartfelt and intelligent presentations. Jason is warmly related to his family, colleagues, audiences, and now is beginning this new role of president of the board in Boston. So congratulations. Very big job. He brings a wonderful perspective of delight along with serious depth in psychological studies and his acknowledgement of the mysterious and the numinous. He's currently writing a book based on his talk, Religious but Not Religious, that was given here last May. How many of you attended that? Oh, good. So good. So now, Jason? If you need this or you need it.
Well, I'm going to try and go with this. Let's see, see if you can hear me. Does that work?
Yes.
All right.
So for audience questions.
For audience questions. Okay, perfect. I'm going to put this over here.
Oh, I forgot to mention a bathroom break. And a break.
So we will take a break. We're going for about 3 hours. We're going until about 4 o'clock. We will take a break somewhere halfway along the way, sometime between 2 and 2:30. Generally, depending on where we are, but just to give you some anchor point in the afternoon. I have a little bit of a cough, which at this point in the day does not manifest, so we should be fine. However, I'm putting it to the test by talking, so we'll see how it goes. So if I have to pop in a lozenge, please excuse me on that account. I'm really thrilled to be back here. I had a fantastic time the last time I was out last May, so I'm grateful to be invited back. I'm grateful for that introduction. Penny was a very important mentor to me going through my training as an analyst. So it's a real joy to be able to be on this side and be colleagues. So I'm glad about that. Let me sneak in a little promo for the Jung Institute, New England Society of Jungian Analysts. I have a couple of postcards here with some of our upcoming programs. So if you're interested, feel free to help yourself. If there are any clinicians in the house, we have an interesting clinical intensive coming up next weekend, and there's some information there. That's my one promo, so I won't belabor that. So this is an interesting topic to talk about. There are a number of traditions, for instance, in the Tao Te Ching, one of the first things that is written is the Tao that is named is not the eternal Tao. So if you can talk about it, if you can name it, it's not the thing. And as one commentator said, and then Lao Tzu goes on for over 80 chapters to talk about a thing that can't be talked about. That's what we're going to do here. We're going to spend 3 hours talking about something that cannot be talked about. Nothing. It's not that there isn't anything that is real. It's that the nothing is what is real. And that's the place that I want to talk out of. With this material, I get to this point where I'm about to talk about this. I've presented this a few times, and I experience something like anxiety because I don't know that I have a grasp on this material, because you cannot have a grasp on this material. And so I can just kind of open up and hope that the necessary words, plus all the ones that I've written down here, will come to our aid today. But this is something that can't be clung to, can't be possessed, can't be known directly. We can touch it as it flows by, we can point to it. The words that we will choose, that I will choose, that I will use, will not be exact descriptions of it, but we want to try to sense our way into this material. That's what we're going to try to do. So this is from Jung's Seven Sermons to the Dead, and this, right in the way of that, this painting, is one that Jung did, and this one is actually called Septem Sermones ad Mortuis, so Seven Sermons to the Dead. This is actually not included in the Red Book, but it's part of the Red Book group of writings. And this is what he writes in the Seven Sermons to the Dead. He says, or he writes, actually, I think this is, these are the words of Philemon. That's how it's imagined. I begin with nothingness. Nothingness is the same as fullness. In infinity, full is no better than empty. Nothing is both empty and full. As well might you say anything else of nothingness, as, for instance, white is it, or black, or again, it is not, or it is. A thing that is infinite and eternal hath no qualities, since it hath all qualities. This nothingness or fullness we name the pleroma. This is from the Seven Sermons to the Dead, which was distributed privately, but it is included in the big edition of the Red Book, the third book, I think, which is called Scrutinies. So this nothingness that is the fullness, empty fullness, the nothing that is but is not, there are many ways that people have tried to name this, the source, the fountainhead, Godhead, ineffable, unknowable, the great mystery. All traditions teach that being in touch with this dimension of experience is when we are most alive. The trick, of course, is to be able to speak about it. Conceptual understanding is not enough. So today, when we're talking, I'm going to try to not only just talk about ideas about this. I'm going to try to bring in some music, some images, just to try to help bring in the feel of this experiential dimension. But where do we start? So let me start with this. This is a little cartoon that kind of describes the problem. All the ways that we try to understand what is going on, theology, psychology, mythology, science, they are what Jung in one of his letters calls veils on the unknowable. We tell stories. We tell stories to try to get a sense of what we're pointing towards. So each story gives us a way of understanding it. In alchemy, what they had a saying, the alchemist had a saying, one book opens another. And what that means is, if you have this book and you're trying to understand these very obscure images and ideas in alchemy, you need another book in order to understand what's in this book. And in order to understand what's in this book, you need another book. And each of these books gives you some understanding so that you can take it to the other, and you can finally get a sense of what's being talked about. Because all of these things are ways of trying to come at something that can't be talked about. And so each image that we use, each story that we use, each theory that we use, all of these provide some glimpse. And my sense of what the Jungian method is to try to pay attention to the resonance between each of these stories. And when Jung talks about the archetype, I think what one of the ways of imagining this is that he's trying to get at the resonance. How is this similar to that? Even though they're different, where are the similarities? Where are the places where they seem similar or they are harmonious with each other? And so all of these different ways of thinking about something, understanding it, looking at it, addressing it, whether it's from the scientific point of view, the psychological point of view, from the religious point of view, from art and music, they are all kind of like notes in a chord. And when you listen to all of them, you get this very rich harmony. And I think we need all of these different ways to be able to grasp this idea of the nothingness, the heart of something, the core of something. And this is what Jung talks about when he talks about the symbol. He says that the symbol is the best possible expression for something that cannot be expressed in any other way. And that's kind of an interesting thing to think about. The symbol is the best expression for something that can't be expressed in any other way. It's an expression. It's not the thing, but it's pointing to it. It's separate, but somehow tied to it. Somehow necessary. Somehow a part of the meaning, but not the full meaning. But the best meaning that we have. When the symbol is alive and resonant, it's the best expression we have pointing at what we're trying to get to. I think that we too are stories. We are stories, each of us individually, stories told by our family, stories told by our culture, stories that we tell about ourselves. Are we things? Are we concrete entities? Or are we constantly unfolding our understanding of ourselves? I think that that's what we're trying to do. So we're stories telling stories. And where do you start? Well, you start where you are. You start with what's in front of you. You start with what you know. And you begin to tell that story and see how those stories begin to open up new thoughts, new ideas, new possibilities. I think it's important to engage in stories and in the different kinds and really try to let them play on us, let them affect us. What we tend to do in our culture is we tend to try to master these stories and see if we go in and we try to decide, is it true or not true? And if it's true, I'm going to invest in this story. Rather than let the story
invite us into some different understanding of ourselves.
This is a picture from a set of Zen pictures, the 10 ox herding pictures, and they're images that describe a process of deepening and enlightenment. And in the commentary on the ox and the herdsman, the 10 ox herding pictures, one Zen Buddhist talks about this. He says, "That upon which we Zen Buddhists resolve lies in one thing alone, the mark of which could be as follows: not to rely on words. Particular transmission outside the teaching." Transmission outside the teaching. So we don't rely on words. We use them. We use the teaching. But the transmission is outside the teaching. It's not the concept. It's what gets transmitted outside of that teaching. To point directly at a person's heart, to see into one's own original nature and become Buddha. We should not allow ourselves to hold fast to any representation or any word. So, to point directly at the heart. So we're moving to some other way of engaging our stories, whatever story it is that we're particularly invested in. Out of a cognitive, conceptual framework into a into the heart, which is not just feeling, but it's a way of participating in the story, of being invested, the way we would in a relationship. In a relationship, it's not just, okay, I've got information about somebody. You are participating in something that is growing and developing. It's not a thing, it's a growing, developing process. The idea of becoming Buddha that he talks about, the Christian tradition has a very similar idea. They talk about putting on the mind of Christ, to become like Christ, to become like Buddha, to awaken Christ consciousness, to awaken Buddha consciousness. And we'll kind of unpack that in different ways as we go through. There's a story in a biography by Lawrence van der Post talking about his first encounter, his first meeting with Jung. And it's at a dinner or something like that, and he's brought into the room where Jung is in conversation at the table with a very distinguished professor, and they're having this conversation about the meaning of fire, the image of fire. And Jung is getting kind of impatient, and apparently at one point he just stops and he says, "It is hellishly difficult to know what you are trying to get at unless you can tell me what fire means, not to primitive people, but to you yourself. It's its meaning for you, not to others, that matters. The meaning for you and not to others. It's not what the meaning of fire is. It's how you participate in that meaning. It's not a conceptual idea." So the professor says something like, "Well, fire, it's obvious, it means energy, of course." And Jung's response, and this is Lawrence van der Post's paraphrase of Jung's response, is that the idea that fire is energy is a meaningless idea. It's a reductive idea. What does that mean? What does that mean? What does fire mean to you? What does fire mean? What's the experience of it? Fire is light in the dark. It's the protection against beasts. It's warmth against the cold. It's the cooking of food in the transformation of elements. It's not an abstract idea, but a concrete complex of experiences that are fundamental to human life and survival. You have to feel into this idea, and then you begin to understand what fire means. Fire is not an idea. These images in our dreams that come up are not abstract ideas. They mean something to us. A wild animal rushing at you is not just, oh, that's my aggression. That's something that's going to tear me apart. It is terrifying. And can I find protection? Can I find safety? That's an experience. It's not an idea. So when we talk about nothingness, and when we talk about emptiness, and when we talk about kenosis, which is the Christian idea of self-emptying, it's a Christian theological idea, and I'm going to spend some time with that. It's important to avoid the temptation to turn this into a concept. Despite the fact that I have to use a lot of words, we're going to try to avoid turning it into an idea and try to get to that fundamental experience of it. Try to kind of feel into the experience of it. That fundamental experience which is expressed in different ways in all of the different religious and wisdom traditions, which, you know, at heart is that saying, be still and know that I am God. It's not have a particular idea of belief, but in that stillness to feel, to know, to have the relationship with what is called God, what is called mystery, what is called the ineffable. So we're going to listen deeply and try to kind of pay attention to what comes up in our own experience, our own psyches. There's a Catholic theologian, and his parentage, I believe his mother's Catholic, his father's Hindu. His name's Raymond Panikkar. Really interesting theologian. Really interesting ideas and very harmonious with a lot of what Jung says. He says this about knowledge. He says, if knowledge is a total human activity and not just an epistemological function of a disincarnated mind, not just conceptual, if it is a total human activity, it is then an assimilation of the being known, a personal embrace in which love is as necessary as cognition, to participate in knowledge and to go from that place of heart. That's how we know something, by relating to it, not by standing back and having an idea about it and holding to our preconceived ideas or a certain kind of superiority over the ideas. We're going to talk about kenosis. I mentioned that. And I want to use kenotic theology. I'm going to be talking in part with using theological ideas. Theology as an image. So this is not theology as a way of subscribing to something or believing in something, but to understand how a certain way of thinking about this idea in the Christian tradition
how this idea has been received, how this idea has been developed, how it has affected the thinking and feeling of a certain group of people, the canonic theologians. So how, and that I see theology similarly in the way that Karen Armstrong talks about it. She says, theology is or should be a species of poetry. Again, poetry. It's not a thing. It's not a this. It is a an image, a way of coming into relationship with something that we can't come to in any other way. And this is, she says, I saw this interview with her on a TV show. She said, you know, you can't read Rilke at a party. I've been to parties with lots of introverts, and you can in those kinds of parties. That's not what she's talking about. She says, poetry can't be read quickly or encountered in a hubbub of noise, because then it makes no sense. You have to open yourself to a poem with a quiet, receptive mind, in the same way you might listen to a difficult piece of music. If you seize upon a poem and try to extort its meaning, that's like the disincarnated mind wants to extort the meaning. It remains opaque. If you bring your own personal agenda to bear upon it, the poem will close upon itself like a clam, because you have denied its unique and separate identity, its inviolate holiness. So we're going to try to stay open to the identity, the unique identity of the nothingness. We're going to look at it from the Christian tradition. We're going to look at it from other traditions, and then we're going to look at it from Jungian psychology and where it shows up there. Recently, I started watching Charlie Chaplin movies with my young son, who loves Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and all these amazing early comic geniuses. This is an image, a really prescient image of the human being caught in the machine. This is us. We are part of the machine. I just reached for my phone to see where it was, because I'm in my machine a lot. I know it's over there in my jacket. I can feel the anxiety because I'm outside of my machine. Oh, I'm going to stay close to my computer. We're so part of the machine that it's become a part of our way of thinking and conceiving of the world. And this image comes from a film called Modern Times. And around the same time that this film was made, Carl Jung wrote an essay called The Development of Personality. And in that essay, he talks about the problem of the standardized, mass-produced, normal human being. And talked about the development of personality in his psychology as a way, as an antidote to that, and was an essay directed towards the hope of fostering growth and development of the individual, and the development of dynamic and creative people able to make important and creative contributions to society.
So the part of the machine, the man, the human being caught in the machine, this one of my favorite images is of Ahab in Moby Dick. And he epitomizes this. And at one point in the novel, Ahab is taunting the gods. And he stands on the deck of his ship and he taunts the gods and he says this. He says, "Come, Ahab's compliments to you. Come and see if you can swerve me." Swerve me? You cannot swerve me, else you swerve yourselves. I am just like you. I am a god. Man has you there. Swerve me. The path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails whereon my soul is grooved to run. Iron rails like the train tracks whereon my soul is grooved to run. Under unsounded gorges, through the rifled hearts of mountains, under torrent's beds, unerringly I rush. Knots an obstacle, knots an angle to the iron way. The iron way. You cannot swerve me. The path to my fixed purpose is laid on iron rails. That is the voice of of the human being caught in the machine, the iron way, the belief that if we work hard enough and figure it out, we can master nature. We can. We don't need the gods. This idea of nothingness and kenosis, which is about self-emptying and about vulnerability. That's not what we're about. We're about where there is a will, an iron will, there is a way. Later in Jung's life, towards the end of his work, he wrote an essay called The Undiscovered Self. And he talks about the religious perspective as being necessary in order to avoid being absorbed by that mass-produced, standardized kind of attitude. And he says, religion, and this is Jung's definition of religion, means dependence on and submission to the irrational facts of experience. Dependence on and submission to the irrational facts of experience. How different is that from the path to my fixed purpose is laid on iron rails? I am dependent, I submit, or I drive. That's very much, very different. Religious imagery, religious symbols are originally experience. And they get taken and they become objects that don't necessarily point beyond themselves, but they become the thing that we serve. And when that happens, the religious image, Jung says, becomes a creed. It becomes the thing we serve and the thing that we get that we believe in. As opposed to the thing that helps us connect to what he calls the transcendent psychic, the God image and its properties. So the image, the symbol, directs us beyond to the nothingness, to the transcendent psychic. Raymond Panikkar, I mentioned him, he talks about the irrational facts of experience, but he calls it the mystical. That's his word for it. And what he says about the mystical is that the mystical is that which cannot be translated into the field of consciousness. It can't be translated into the field of consciousness except by way of symbols. So from the perspective of rational consciousness, the mystical doesn't mean anything. It's empty of meaning because
we can't talk about it. We can't hold on to it. We can't contain it. It's the non-rational. But emptiness is actually the truest form of expression of this realm. I want to play a piece of music here. This is from a composer, I can't pronounce this very well, Arvo Pärt. And he talks about his music and he says, you know, his music comes out of silence. So this is music that grows out of silence. And this particular piece, Fractures, is meant to capture the feeling of the fact that the momentary, the instant, the frantic experience of life and the eternal are both present in us at every moment, and they compete with each other and interact with each other. They're struggling together. And hear it come out of the silence. Back to be frantic again. I was listening to this time through, putting in and out. Speaking of the experience I sometimes have of being in these moments where I'm reflecting on something, or I have this experience of either meditation or music or art, and it's very profound, and then I've got to get out the door to a soccer practice, or and I'm moving. I mean, it's, we can't stay there too long. It's almost impossible. And so that the rhythms and the frantic and the anxiety, but then every now and then we touch these places of this depth and the stillness, and we have intimations of that place. And then every now and then they kind of work together. They're not battling with each other, but they're in harmony with each other. I think the music does a beautiful job of capturing it. This is Jung's theory of analysis or therapy. Says, my aim is to bring about a psychic state in which my patient begins to experiment with his own nature, a state of fluidity, change, and growth, where nothing is eternally fixed and hopelessly petrified. So this emptying of a sense of self, an emptying of the fixed sense of who we are, of that laid down on iron rails in which our soul is grooved to run, to something more fluid. Who are we in the moment? In that one moment where I'm by myself in a state of reverie, and the next moment where I am a parent who has two places to be at once. I am a different person in each of those moments. When I'm standing here with all of you, this constellates something about each of us that is different than when we'll be somewhere else. And so to be able to feel that fluidity, I think, is essential. Let me give you one more image. This is from the movie Wings of Desire. Is anybody familiar with this movie? So if you're not familiar with this movie, these two, and you'll see several of them, are angels. And the angels long to be connected to this world. So they have, they're often seen behind individuals. And you get this feeling from this movie of this other realm, this transcendent realm that wants to be realized in earthly life. That there's a longing for earthly life. And when we're talking about kenosis, it's not just a self-emptying to this deeper dimension, but it's also about the longing for the deeper dimension to be present in earthly life, where there's a coming together of these, not a leaving of this for that, not a denial of that for this, but some place where this is infused with that deeper dimension. And so the angels long to be part of the world. And this is the experience where they go into a library to listen to the symphony of human thought.
Thank you.
Different scene, obviously.
I can't see it, but I know you're here. I feel it. You've been hanging around since I got here. I wish I could see your face. Just look into your eyes and tell you how good it is to be here. Just to touch something. See, that's cold. Mm-hmm. I feel good. Good for the air. To smoke. Have coffee. And if you do it together, it's fantastic. Or to draw. You know, you take a pencil and you make a dark line. Then you make a light line. And together it's a good line. Oh, your hands are cold. You're up together. See, that's good. That feels good. There's so many good things. But you're not here. I'm here. I wish you were here. I wish you could talk to me. Because I'm a friend. Companiero.
So many good things. How good it is to be here.
And when you do it together, it's fantastic. We're going to talk later about what the image of the Trinity means, but just a spoiler alert, relationship, connection, to do it together. That's when something, the third thing, something between us happens. Something manifests. There's this side, and something between comes forward. These two different dimensions that need to be known, that need to be connected to each other. We might talk about them as transcendence and immanence. There are many different ways to look at them. to open, to empty, is to open to this larger dimension, to let the larger dimension in. So to empty is to allow this other in. In canonic theology, God empties in order to come into this world. So there's an emptying of
our receiving, there's an emptying in order for the transcendent to come in here. And it creates what one theologian talks about as a way out of the modern ideal of the tightly packaged individual separate self. A self separate from all other selves and marked by an anxiety-generated subjectivity. We are separate. Myself is tightly packaged. It's very separate. We are bounded by anxiety. I'm anxious that I might be known. I'm anxious that something that I don't intend might manifest if I open to somebody else, something else. It might not be what I expect. So we protect ourselves in our tightly packaged self. So we have these two dimensions that seek each other out. We have what we might be called transcendence and immanence, unconscious, conscious, the divine, the human, archetypal, personal, in the mind, in the senses, the spiritual, the biological, self, ego. When they meet, when they can reach that third place, the interpenetration, we get what Jung calls the psychoid. Jung's notion of psychic reality is that it is neither a product of the actual objective behavior of things. It's not just the actual physical reality, nor of the formulated idea exclusively. So it's not just an idea, it's not just an abstract thing, but a combination of both in a living psychological process where the transcendent meets the immanent, where thought meets reality, where self meets other, the self and the ego. This place of the psychoid is this place where the edge, the boundary between psyche, mind, and matter, where is that edge? It's that very unknowable edge where both are of the same they come together in the same thing. They are one. They're two sides of the same coin, so to speak. This place of the psychoid, so this shape here in the middle, this sort of almond shape, this is called the mandorla. In Jungian psychology, we talk about the mandala a lot, but there's this shape also, which is the mandorla. And this shows up in a number of images. So we have a Greek Orphic image of Phanes. And you can see the circle around Phanes. Phanes is a male, female deity of light and goodness. So it's male, female. It's the firstborn god. It's the first manifestation out of the nothing. Phanes means to shine forth. So it's that moment when the nothing becomes, starts to be manifest. It's the male, female deity of light and goodness. And the name Phanes is given, or is part of the word, the Greek word phanestai, which means to shine forth, which is where we get our word phenomenon. So it's the shining forth when something becomes something, the moment something becomes something. Joseph Campbell talks about this image. He says, contemplating this image, one is to think of the veil of space-time as parting to reveal a personification of the ground of being. A meditation proper to any to such an epiphany would be, may I come by this God
to the knowledge of my own radiant truth enclosed in the coils of my temporal life. My own radiant truth enclosed in the coils of my temporal life. There's that middle ground, the immanent, the transcendent, the radiant truth that shines forth in the everyday. Alchemy has a similar image. This is the image of the peacock's tail, the cauda pavonis. And you can see, again, it's in a vessel, sort of in that kind of ovalish shape. That's the alchemical vessel. So the peacock's tail represents dawn, the moment when the new day breaks. So there's that shining forth again. And out of the negredo, out of the blackness, comes the many colors of the peacock's tail. So it's the shining forth from nothing into something. And then there is the Christian image. And there you can see very clearly the mandorla shape. And this is a very common shape in a lot of Christian iconography, the mandorla. And Jesus is that image of the transcendent and the immanent come together, the divine and the human, fully divine, fully human in one. So it's the meeting of that ground and the ground of being and our being. This is a mutual movement of the divine towards the human and the human towards the divine. We've got a few moments, so let's just go a little bit further, and let me just introduce this idea a little bit more of the theology of kenosis. And again, I want to emphasize that what I'm talking about here with the theology is to start to get a sense of how this idea has been developed, how this idea has been worked on, how human consciousness has worked with this idea, and what it comes to, and what it does to our understanding of God, or to the way God might be thought of. Because one of the things that it does is it changes, it introduces the idea that change happens to God. And this is very different than the very classical idea of God as immutable and unchangeable. So in the 17th century, a number of German theologians started to look at the Gospels, and they started to wonder, why is it that in the Gospels there is no reference to Jesus using his divine attributes during his lifetime? He does not display omnipotence, and he does not display omniscience. So why is that? So they look at this and they think about it, and the first possibility that presents itself is that, well, of course he did. Of course he used omnipotence and omniscience. He just did it secretly and no one knows about it. So this is the hidden use of his divine powers, which is called crypsis. The other possibility is that he abstains from using his divine powers. He gives them up. And this is called kenosis. And later on, another theologian comes back to this and says, no, he didn't just abstain. He abandoned his divinity. He gave it up. And this idea of kenosis as a way of thinking about the Gospels and way of thinking about Jesus is very controversial. There are people, particular
points of view that see it as something of a heresy. Because of the implications of it. Because the implication is something happens to God by becoming Jesus, by becoming the Christ. And God is not this all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful experience. And canonic thinking, so there's a guy named McCullough, he wrote a book which is this thick, it's called Christianity, the First 3,000 Years. I'm about 5 years into it, reading. He says that canonic thinking repeatedly finds its way back into the Western Christian theology. So it gets banished and it comes back and it gets banished and it comes back. In Eastern Orthodox traditions, this is fundamental to kind of the canonic is the heart of their seeing and practicing of Christianity.
Jason?
Yes?
Could you give an example of how it disappears and comes back? Somehow I wanted to grasp that a little more.
So, I don't know that I have any concrete examples, except that, the comparison would be alchemy. So, there's the Christianity, Jung talks about Christianity on the surface. And he says that there's this undercurrent to Christianity, which is alchemy, which is this response to Christianity that feels like something's left out. And so it's this kind of undercurrent, secret way of dealing with the same material. So it's present. It's almost like the shadow of the Christianity on the surface. And kenosis, canonic theology, is similar in that it comes in, and there are people who come in. So there's a group, and I can't remember when they are. They're the Pietists, and they're moved by the canonic. But that's a heresy. It comes up as a heresy because these different traditions are seen as they're either too passive or there's something that they try to bring in that's not part of the scripture or the part of the accepted theology. And so it kind of gets swallowed up again and it goes underground for a little while or it disappears. And then someone comes along who's a very contemplative person and is able to articulate and all of a sudden canonic theology comes back. And it seems like maybe that it's that combination, that it needs both the contemplative and the capacity to talk about it. I think Thomas Merton is one of these people. When he talks about it, there's very much a canonic element in his, and his work is very engaging. And,
could you just define canonic again for us? Is it the abandonment that God abandons omniscience in order to incarnate?
Yeah. So let's go here, because this is next. We need to do this. So kenosis comes from what's called the Christian, and this is from Philippians 2, verses 5 through 11. So this is, let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself. Emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness, and being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. So it's that emptying that is kenosis. It's self-emptying.
Kenosis comes from the Greek word keno. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. The phrase in Greek is houten en ekenosen, to empty himself. And so it's the idea that in order to incarnate, Jesus empties himself of his identity with God to become human.
This is scriptural?
This is scriptural. This is from Philippians. And we'll talk in a second about the different ways that this is thought, but the main piece is here. Did not regard equality with God to be something to be exploited, emptied himself, humbled himself, became obedient. Those are all taken as elements of kenosis, the emptying, the kenosis of God. The hymn goes on and it talks about, therefore God also exalted him, gave him the name above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee should bend, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. So there's the humbling, the coming down, and the exaltation. That's all contained in this hymn. So emptying is both a humbling, but then it results in the exaltation. So it's this paradox of both a kind of humility, a humbling, but also this divinization. So letting go of identity with God, becoming God.
Would it also be letting go of the self? Like just letting go of self? And within, when in that letting go of self, everything emerges, like from the emptiness? More from Buddhist, you know,
yes. Yes, so from the Buddhist perspective, yes, it is the no self, the anatta,
right.
And in doing that,
it all, everything,
right,
which is kind of is even pointing to,
right,
the same thing, right?
Yes, that's exactly it. And in fact, Buddhist, many Buddhist philosophers find kenosis and the idea of kenosis as the place where the two systems and other systems can find harmony and communicate with each other. This is the place where they can meet and agree. That's what they say. Yes?
I'm also thinking of St. John at the cross, emptying oneself and oneself to be filled by God, which I was thinking was similar to kenosis, but now seems to be the opposite. Because it's not emptying oneself of God, it's emptying oneself of oneself, which is what the woman mentioned.
Yes, yes. Right, and so that's that there are, and at the same time, and we'll talk about this psychologically, in letting go of the self, we let go of what Jung calls our godlikeness. Because in letting go of the self, our identity with the self, which is this larger self, this larger picture, if we let go of our identity, we let go of our attachment to omnipotentiality, our own omnipotence. We want to be everything and all things. We want to experience everything. And incarnation, psychologically, is self-limitation. What life are you going to live? What do you let go of, and what do you choose to engage? So, yes, it's self-limiting. So it's kind of both and. Are there any other thoughts or questions? Let's do a couple more questions. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back. So I see one over here.
I'm just curious. Is kenosis related to the idea of gnosis, spelled with a G, and Gnostics, and Gnosticism?
I don't think that they are I don't think they're similar. The verbs are different because gnosis is about knowing and about a way of knowing. Though probably if we dig into it, we'd find that there's something, because the knowledge of gnosis is about a kind of a participatory knowledge. So there's probably something very similar. Over here, there was one right here, yes.
There are many places in the gospel where Jesus says, in order to gain your life, you have to be willing to lose it.
Yes.
So it's going in this vein as well.
Right, right. In order to gain your life, you have to lose it. Who will not lose their life won't gain it. He also says at different points, do not cling to me. Yeah. Right? Do not cling to me. So in many ways, a number of commenters have noticed that the image and the story of Jesus is that he's always pointing beyond himself. Even the crucifixion is to go beyond him. So yes, absolutely. There's one back there, yes.
Yeah, it just was occurring to me that, like, the identity to me feels like the place where we cling in the psyche.
Yes.
When you identify with a thing. And then anytime you cling to a thing, you're not open to the relationship between things. And that what you were talking about with the alchemy in relationship to Christianity, what I'm hearing is that Christianity has sort of clung to certain idols, and they've let go of the feminine, which is that submitting, the opposite of Ahab, and that is what's been missing in the Christian faith.
Right.
And that fits in with the fluidity. If you submit and let go of the things that you tend to attach to, you'll be part of the current and the flow.
Right. The creed that Jung, when Jung talks about the difference between religion and creed, the creed is when the symbol becomes the sort of the self-justification of the religious practice. It's about maintaining the symbol and not being able to allow the symbol to maintain its transparency to the transcendence. And I think you're right. There is an element of the feminine in that, and hopefully at some point will come through in what we're talking about. How about, is there one more question? If there's not, why don't we take a break? We'll come back in about 10, 15 minutes, and we'll continue from here.
If you don't already know, we are a completely non-profit group, and the only money that we take in is from your donations at the door. So your interest sustains us both spiritually and physically. So physically, please make a contribution before you leave if you haven't already. Thanks.
Okay. I brought this image back up just for a moment. Excuse me. Someone came up and mentioned the image and knew the artist, and I didn't mention her name. Jan Richardson is the artist of this and one of the later images. This image is called, I believe it's called End and Beginning. I like the mandala shape of it, but the inspiration for the image is it's an Advent image. So So it's for the season of Advent in the Christian tradition. And the season of Advent is preceded by a series of scriptural passages on what's called the mini apocalypse. So all of the scriptural passages right before the Advent season, which comes right before Christmas, are about the end of time, the end of the world. It's this sort of apocalyptic piece, and the idea being the kind of end before the beginning, before the new beginning. And so it's very much a kenotic image of an emptying in order for that new infusion of the divine to come in. And this image where that we left off with in the Christ hymn is also one of her images, and this one is called Into the Emptying. So again, it's a...
Jason, isn't this a detail?
This is a detail. It captures a good percentage of the piece. So I mentioned before we stopped that kenosis comes from this, the seed of the idea of kenosis comes from this passage. This hymn is thought to be sort of one of the early kind of creedal statements of the early church. One writer calls it the gospel writ small. So in this hymn, those lines that we've read, that's it. That's the gospel. And it refers to these three stages of Christ's existence. His pre-existence, his earthly career, and the death and resurrection. Yes?
I just had a question on the first part of this quote that was on the previous page.
Yep.
It was said that Jesus became obedient and a slave.
Yes.
Just the form of a slave and became obedient. To whom? To God or to human nature?
He's obedient to God. It's obedient pouring out of love and obedience to God's will. That's the way it's understood.
So the form of the slave would imply that God is the master?
I think that's different. It's more
slave to human.
Right. So a servant to his, you know, serves at God's will, serves at, the process of redemption.
But the authentic intention.
Serves the
authentic intention, whatever that might be.
Yeah, we'll get into this, but one writer looks at this and says that what this reveals is not what he becomes, but sort of what he is. That his being is the pouring out of self for others. And the intention is that of whoever shall serve shall be the first. Whoever is last shall be first. In one of the passages, there's this argument amongst the disciples about who's the greatest and who's going to sit by his side. And he says, whoever serves will be will be first. Whoever's last will be first, and whoever's first will be last. And so it reverses the whole idea of what is to be exalted, what is to be valued, which is to give oneself away. And I think that's where the slave piece comes. But it's a difficult word to reconcile.
For he gives up will.
He gives up will. He gives up ego, yes. So what happens with this is that as I said, it introduces this change in the idea of God, that the traditional understanding is God is omnipotent and immutable, eternal and immutable, and kenosis is a radical challenge to this. Kenotic theology means that it brings about a radical change in the eternal word. And this is a theologian called Keith Ward, and he says, the word, being in the form of God, is properly omnipotent, omniscient, and perfectly good. When the word becomes flesh, however, he empties himself of some of these divine attributes. Generally speaking, when the word takes the form of a man, he gives up omnipotence and omniscience. So God changes. And what that means is we get a different understanding and experience of God. We have a difference between the omnipotent God. Here is the omnipotent God with his feet on the earth, all-powerful, and this is the suffering God. This is the God who enters into human existence and understands as if from the inside. Participates in the sufferings and trials of human existence. So theologically, the idea is that instead of what is called, instead of simply having propositional knowledge of what it means to be human, an idea, God gets affective knowledge. He gets the knowledge of what it is to be a human being. So he becomes a human being and knows what that is from the inside. So God learns. He doesn't just have an idea. It's not just directing things from the outside, but participates. So this is what makes this theological idea very radical. He's not out. He's here suffering. So if we just think for a moment about what it means that God is affected by what takes place in creation. What does that mean if we just think about that psychologically? Let's take it out of theological terms and let's think about what that means. What does it mean to think about when we are driven by an omnipotent God, when our sense of being is rooted in this idea of omnipotence and immutability and unchangeability, versus what it means when our connection to that deepest archetypal layer is one of participation and suffering. So, from the point of view of the omnipotent God, we are victims. We are either perpetrator or victim, and we have to be fixed, healed. So there's something wrong, there's something that happens to us. We don't participate, it's not a relationship. We just have to deal.
God is outside of the story. He stands apart, unmoved. The suffering God, God is inside the story. You can already start to feel the difference. There's a sense of softness there. There's a sense of that fluidity versus the fixed nature. With the omnipotent God, there's kind of comes with the idea of there's a goal. There's something that I must do. I have a calling. I've got to take care of this thing. We're very goal focused. When we're connected to an archetypal depth that is this suffering God. In the Islamic tradition, they talk about the pathetic God, the God that has pathos for the suffering of humanity, that feels the suffering of humanity. It's not the goal, it's the journey. It's the way of getting there. It's the experience of getting there. With an omnipotent God, we are on our own. We're self-made human beings. We're on our own to make it or not. The suffering God is the companion. We're part of something. And you can start to see how it changes maybe how we interact. When you talk about the tightly packaged self, right? There was a report recently about a study done on the roots of mental illness in millennials. And one of the main issues was perfectionism. Go online and today you can read 8 million blogs about 10 ways to be the most perfect self that ever existed on the planet. To be more productive, to be stronger, faster, to just be better in 100 million ways. Faster, efficient. So this idea of perfectionism drives our culture. The omnipotent God is the God of technology that wants to control everything. The suffering God is the God that has compassion. To have compassion for ourselves, to have compassion for each other, to have empathy, to be able to feel empathy for our humanness. Our imperfection, our inability to get things right on some levels, the fact that we make mistakes, the fact that no matter how much we meditate, no matter how many degrees we get, no matter how many self-help books we read, we still do stupid things. The suffering God can participate in that. We can be connected and be more forgiving of ourselves and others. It creates this place where relationship, connection, empathy are possible. So it's significant. It's a significant archetypal difference. In the theological approach to kenosis, there are essentially three ways that this idea gets developed. So there's what's called the Christological aspect of kenosis, there's the Trinitarian, and the cosmological. And obviously, we're still in the Christian tradition here, and we're going to move out of the Christian tradition in a moment. What I like about using kenosis and not just emptiness is kenosis, that it has this complexity. Not that the others don't have complexity, but it has these different ways, and we have to really wrestle with it a little bit.
And we're not used to doing this with wrestling in this way. We tend to either, with Christianity, these as sort of the Judeo-Christian roots of our culture, we either kind of say yes or no. We don't just get into the muck and wrestle with it. So the Christological, the Trinitarian, and the cosmological. And I'll go through this relatively quickly, and we'll move to some other areas here. So this is an image of the Annunciation by Henry Osawa Tanner. And here is Mary, and here is Gabriel, the angel. It's a little different angel than we saw from the Vin Vendors movie. But if you look at this image, so here's the transcendent breaking through into the earthly. It almost has that mandorla shape to it. You can kind of see the shining forth moment here. One of the central issues in the Christological approach, the Christological approach has to do with the figure of Christ. And in the Christological approach, one of the problems or the things that they wrestle with is the relationship of Christ's humanity to Christ's divinity. How do these relate? He's fully human, he's fully divine, and how do you even begin to think about that? The other piece when we're thinking about kenosis is when it says that Christ emptied himself, the question is, well, he emptied himself of what? That was the question that we had before. What does that mean? What is he emptying? Does he empty himself of his divinity? Is it divinity that's being emptied? Or when he is coming and living amongst us, is it humanity that's being emptied? What is being emptied? So the idea that kenosis means to empty and that it refers to Christ self-emptying, okay, that's fine. No, we don't have a problem with that. Theology understands that part. They wrestle with what's being emptied. So the answer to that question tends to follow one of two readings. On the one hand, Christ's self-emptying is understood in terms of the incarnation. Christ incarnates, and therefore he empties himself of his divinity. And it's a setting aside of his pre-existent divinity. It's one of those three forms, the pre-existent divinity. On the other hand, when we talk about he emptied himself, it's read as a parallel, and we saw that in the hymn, of he humbled himself. So it's the humbling as a human being. So it's an emptying of kind of the more human dimension, and it emphasizes his crucifixion and resurrection. So one is an emphasis on the incarnation, one is an emphasis on the crucifixion. So if incarnation highlights the emptying of divinity, he doesn't cling to the form of God but empties himself. It's an emptying, we might think of it, as those aspects of divinity that keep God at an unbridgeable distance from human beings. So that unbridgeable gap, the omnipotent God who's outside of our experience. Again, we mentioned this before, we can think of that psychologically as the giving up of omnipotentiality, the human being, the part of us that doesn't want to grow up and wants to have all possibilities. You know, this is a one of the things that we often will talk about is experiences. People want new experiences, and we collect experiences and want to experience as many things as possible. The human life becomes a human life by limitation. Not doing everything, but doing this thing. If I choose to get married and have a wife and family, I am choosing that and not choosing to experience never getting married and having a wife and family. All of a sudden, all potentials have become limited. And now I'm on this ride. I'm on this experience. And what happens is that choice defines and makes up the experience of what my life is. So incarnation is that process of going into this life, into limits, this experience, this work, this choice. It's about becoming an individual. That's the individuation process. On the other hand, crucifixion stresses the kenotic path of the individual life, the kenotic path of service, of one writer says that the Christian path is to become a suffering servant, to serve others. And so it's not Jesus' appearance in human form that is focused on, it's his death and resurrection. And this is kind of what much of Christianity tends to focus on. It focuses on the death and resurrection. And the idea that the image of Christ represents, you know, Jesus is God, Jesus is Lord. And that's in that hymn too. And it's often about that kind of self-sacrificing way of being in the world. And that is also part of the experience of becoming a person, which is that, you know, when we give ourselves to something, we give ourselves in service to it. We make sacrifices for that. Crucifixion, psychologically, we might think of as wrestling with the tensions of opposites in our own experience. The conflicts of duty. Being torn between, for instance, my need for creative growth and development and my need to be a good father to my children. Where is the tension between what? How much do I sacrifice? Do I sacrifice all of myself and what I need for my own development, for my children? Do I sacrifice their well-being so that I can become a fully realized human being by myself? There's a tension in there. Mothers are often in that very kind of self-sacrificing mode. And one of the criticisms, by the way, in feminist theology of this notion of kenosis is that particularly for women, it can become a way of kind of undergirding forms of subservience and self-abasement that women often need to overcome. So there are shadow elements to this that need to be recognized. Thinking theologically, we might kind of frame the two differences or the two pieces as incarnation
the Christology that focuses on incarnation focuses on love. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. He wants to be part of the world. It's about love. The crucifixion tends to emphasize the sin of the human being and the need for redemption and repair. So the just two different emphases, two different ways that that gets played out. But it's also a kind of mutual movement. So the movement of the divine towards the human towards the divine. And in some way, we could say that incarnation and crucifixion, as images, as psychological experiences, are two sides of the same coin. To incarnate is painful and does create this place of conflict and tension. When we choose something, we often have to sacrifice something else to give it up. Incarnation can be painful. To say, in this life, I am going to give my major time and energy to becoming a Jungian analyst and being a Jungian analyst, and maybe this is not the lifetime that I will become an accomplished musician. You know, those are pieces of emptying and letting go. We all have places of choosing away from something, sacrificing something that is meaningful and valuable because something else might have more value. So our call, if we think about it in that way, can be painful. There's a really vivid illustration of how painful incarnation can be. About a year or two ago, remember the astronaut, I think his name is John Kelly, and he was spent a year on the space station, and he returned after a year. He's 52 years old. Scott Kelly. Thank you. He was being interviewed, and he said that when he first came back to Earth, it was painful. It hurt. It hurt to wear clothes. He spent a year in space, and his clothes floated off of his body, so nothing really touched his skin for a year. And then when he came back, lying down, having clothes on, it was painful and it burned. It burned to sit or lie or walk. Now imagine you're God and you take the form of a human being. And all of a sudden you feel hunger pains and you feel tired and all of the experiences of an embodied life and bringing that fullness of the divine self into that. Incarnation is painful. And it's painful for us. Are all of the potentials that we have that become narrowed. That's not an easy process. To be human, so that idea of perfection, and I should be better at this, and I should know how to do this. I had a woman in my office, a consultation a number of years ago, who was embarrassed to be there because she was trying to figure out what she wanted to do. She kept saying, I should know how to do this. And I kept saying, why? Where would you have learned it? Why? I should be able to do this on my own. Why? But that idea that we have that we are this, we should know how, it's very painful to be human and to come into existence. The Trinitarian idea kenosis seen through the Trinity. So these different ideas, by the way, the Christological, the Trinitarian, and the cosmological, you can think of them almost like nested dolls, right? So it starts off, theologians look at Christ and they look at this idea of kenosis and they see
this idea of Christ emptying himself and giving himself. And then that makes them go, well, okay, if he does that here, is that must be his nature, which means it's the nature of God, because Jesus is one part of God. The Trinity is not God or Jesus, or God is not Jesus, it's the Trinity. God just got confused there, because it's confusing. God in the Christian tradition, properly speaking, is the Trinity. It's not Jesus, it's not the Holy Spirit. It's the Trinity. It's this outpouring from one to the other. So if that's what Jesus does when he's here, that must be the nature of, that must be his nature, Jesus' nature. Therefore, it must be part of God's nature. And so they start to think about the kenotic dimension of the Trinity. And so you get this idea that the Trinity is this outpouring of love from Father to Son, from Son to the Spirit, from the Spirit back to the Father. And the word they use for this mutual outpouring, this kind of water wheel, one writer talks about, of this outpouring of love from one to the other, to the other, to the other, is kenosis. God is a pouring out of oneself. Let's go back to the, think about that, what that means as a psychological image. It means that we are not self-sufficient entities. We're not separate entities. And that goes back to that idea of relationship, that we presuppose each other in some way. That the me standing here in front of you is somehow in relationship and in response to everything that's going on in this room. And so, where do I end and you begin? Where is that boundary line? That's what this refers to. And so our connections with each other, the underpinning, is that I am not I, that we are not separate beings, that we somehow coexist. And so the word that is used in the literature is perichoresis, a circle dance. God is a circle dance from one to the other. And that there's this this constant kind of movement. And I like that idea of the dance, because the dance is not a fixed thing. The dance is not a journey. The dance doesn't have a focus or a goal. Alan Watts talks about this, where he says, you know, in music, there isn't a goal. It's not that the whole point of the piece of music is to get to the final chord. And if you're dancing, it's not that you have to get to a place on the floor. It's the dance. It's being in the dance. And so if the notion of God is a dance, a circle dance, how does that change our experience of being human? What does that mean about how we live? All of our ideas about God, whatever the metaphysical background is or is not, and I can't touch that, but all of our ideas about God, our experiences of God, have to do with what does it mean to be a human being and to live a human life. And that's part of the outpouring too. That's part of the circle dance. What does it mean to be a human being, and how does that make me think about God, and how does that idea of God make me think about myself as a human being? And now we're in a relationship. And now we're in a dance. And out of that idea that God's essence is this outpouring and this perichoresis and this kenotic, then you get this cosmological idea, and the kenotic theologians see kenosis as a way to harmonize theology with evolutionary science, to say that God opens a space, creates something that is not God, so removes God's self from the picture so that creation can form and take place. Yeah, I got a question for that.
Does God
Does the outpouring of love from Father to Son to Spirit to Father also go in the other direction or not? Is it a one-way, or does it also go Father to Spirit to Son?
Yeah, I don't think it's a one-way thing. There are different ways that the Trinity is conceived. So there are ways in which the emphasis is sometimes on Father and Son, and the Holy Spirit is the relationship between them. So there are different ways. So I wouldn't get too locked in the one direction. Though, scripturally, God sends Jesus to earth, and then Jesus says the Holy Spirit will come. So, you know, in the scripture, that does go in that direction, from God to Jesus to the Spirit. That's beyond my theological knowledge. It's a good question.
So I heard a Latino theologian call the Trinity the Tres Amigos.
The Tres Amigos. Yes. Yes. And the idea of persons, right? The three persons of the Trinity. That's a difficult word, and it shouldn't be thought of as a individual as much as it should be a state.
It's all metaphor.
It's all metaphor, right? And as soon as you say it, you have to say, "Well, it's not that." But those are the words that we have. It's hard to use language and stay in the non-dual expression, because as soon as language comes from our rational way of thinking, and rational needs these opposites in order to kind of make sense of itself. Yes, sir.
Since we're on the topic, and tell me if this is off track, but these are symbols, and I always like to hear another effort at what they are. What is the Spirit? What is the Son? And what is the Father? How are they different? How are they not just He knows? Yeah. How do you describe each one?
There are probably more ways than I am wise enough to look at, but the way that I have, the place that I have got to around that is this idea of something like the ground of being, like the nothingness out of which would come God, to the lived experience of that in Jesus, and then what we will get to, which is the creative co-creation out of that, the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. That's the Holy Spirit's role, is the ongoing development, perpetuation of the church. The cosmological idea there is a self-emptying in nature. So if we just look at this, God's very act, this is this theologian Peacock. God's very act of creating something other than God's self, with a given degree of autonomy, is itself an act of self-limitation. So it's a vision of God not as an omnipotent agent controlling and manipulating all events, but one in which God empties a space in which the created world is then allowed by its creator to create itself. Freedom to create itself. The emergence of an unfolding of life is not predetermined, but proceeds more along the lines of an improvisation. That's evolution. God's relationship with the world is not one of overpowering might, but rather
creative empowerment. So that's the way it's seen, that if we understand kenosis as part of this natural process, then God's involvement has to be something like creative empowerment. It also means that we are co-creators. That the human being is a co-creator of life in the world. And that has implications. It means what we do matters. That our way of being in the world matters. And we know that this is true. I've got friends and colleagues in the Santa Barbara area, because I went to Pacifica Graduate Institute, and they were under evacuation orders because of wildfires for a long time, and now they're under evacuation orders because of mudslides, and the death toll there is awful, and we live in this fragile world, and the things that we are doing to it are making it more fragile. We are co-creators, for good or ill, of what happens around us. When the Boston bombing happened at the marathon, and I was watching the news reports, I was actually driving home from the Jung Institute when it happened, so I'd been near there, and I was able to, got up before it happened. I looked at the news reports of all of those people who rushed towards where the explosion was to help. And I thought, what would I do? Would I run the other way? Or would I run to help? To me, that capacity to run towards, to be a helper, to be the one who... when something awful happens, comes in. That's redemption. That's what redemption means. And whether you think that there's a divine background to that or not, that's the image of it for me. When something happens, do we try to redeem and make better? Or do we pull back and say it's not our business? Do we fall to that omnipotence, or do we go to the suffering? Is our background the omnipotent God or the suffering God that goes in? I don't know what my answer is. So this idea then creates a vulnerability in God. This is where the whole idea of kenosis becomes really troubling, because it creates a vulnerability.
Is it a vulnerability in God, or is it a vulnerability in ourselves?
Yes.
In order to receive or to hear?
Yes.
So there's a difference.
It's both. So the idea is that God creates the space, and which is vulnerable,
yeah,
and allows things to proceed. And therefore, without, you know, it can go wrong. So, in our whatever our work is, similar kind of thing, we start to engage in something, and it could not work out. If you start, something, it is consequential. It's not an easy thing. It's what Jung calls an act of high courage flung in the face of life to do anything, because it might not work out. So to do anything is to engage in a vulnerable act. And so, as human beings, we are seeds. So this image, here's the mandorla again, and there is the human being inside of nature, part of nature. A seed inside of nature. We are seeds seeding. We are part of nature, and we are seeding something out of our work, out of our being, out of our relationships that that goes forward. That's the all of the kenotic processes in nature, the individual species that sacrifice themselves for their offspring. That's kenotic. That there's that forward movement and outpouring, self-emptying into something else. I'm going to skip over this because this is meant just to be a review, and we did kind of the psychological piece as we went along. This is an image, by the way, from NASA's website, and it is a nebula, an hourglass planetary nebula, and its nuclear fuel is exhausted, so it's dying. This is a dying star. And look, there's the mandorla, right there. So this star is dying. But what's happening to it is it's seeding other stars. This dying star becomes other stars. So this is the kenotic in the universe. And this image just blew me away when I saw it. I thought, I don't even know what to make of that. That's just... that's where you go silent. And you go, oh, you know, it's I'm not moving here. I'm going to do a quick survey. We have about half an hour, so I'm going to do a quick survey of how this plays out. I spent a lot of time with Christianity, so I'm going to go through a few areas where this idea of kenosis, emptiness, where it resonates with some of the other religious traditions. And then there's a section in here on kenosis and depth psychology. I'm going to skip over that and go to Jung. And then we'll end there talking about Jung. So, this is in Judaism. Now, I'm probably making too much of this in this moment. But there's that shape again that kind of shows up.
On the tree of life.
The Kabbalistic tree of life. Exactly. These points on the tree of life, this sephiral from the crown down to the root here, they are emanations from the unmanifest, starting with this idea of Ein. Ein means no thing. Ein is beyond existence, separate from anything. Ein is absolute nothing. It's not above or below. It's neither still nor in motion. There is nowhere where Ein is, for it is, for Ein is not. Ein is soundless, but neither is it silent. Nor is it a void, and yet out of the zero of Ein's no-thingness comes the one of Ein Sof. That's God prior to his self-manifestation. So there's Ein Sof, which is before manifestation. It's right at that sort of shining forth moment, and prior to that is the nothingness of Ein. And the suffering servant comes from Isaiah... in the Hebrew scriptures, And this, the man of sorrows or the suffering servant, is what Christians identify. They identify this figure in Judaism with Jesus. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. With his wounds we are healed. This is the image that in Buddhism would be similar to the Bodhisattva, the one who postpones enlightenment in order to participate in the sorrows and sufferings of humanity.
What was the text that we just read?
That's Isaiah 53. And the idea that through our woundedness, I think this is partly about the fact that through our woundedness we are healed. We tend to think of healing as getting better, but somehow that healing comes through an acknowledgement of compassion and empathy with our woundedness and with the woundedness of others. Because through our woundedness we become open to the other. The crack is where the light gets in, as Leonard Cohen sings. And we become open when we become wounded. And therefore, you know, people who have been through the process of grief understand grief, and they understand another person's grief and can be there and meet that person. And the other person's grief is not taken away, but it's healed. Not because it's removed, but because it's companioned. Because you're not alone. And it's in not being alone where healing comes. It's back to the relationship. This is the work of analysis. It's not about fixing what doesn't work and making it go away. It's about not being alone, because our wounds, our psychic wounds, often make us cut off from other people. And to be able to be met and understood, that's human. So through our wounds, we're healed. In Islam, the very name of Islam means peace and surrender. So kenosis is in the name. And then there's this idea of al-Batin, the hidden one. And al-Batin it's the unknown, unknowable aspect of God. It's the hidden aspect of God. But in reciting the name al-Batin, it's regarded by some Muslims in having the power to enable the speaker of the name to see the truth in things. So to connect to the hidden God is to be able to see the truth, because you see beyond form, you see behind. You see the form behind the form, it's shining through. And Allah, in a very famous hadith, which are sayings of the Prophet Muhammad that aren't in the Quran, says this: I was a hidden treasure and I wished to be known, so I created a creation, then made myself known to them, and they recognized me. I wish to be known. I was a hidden treasure and I wish to be known. God is relationship, wishes to be known. It's the in-betweenness. It's the relatedness. So, psychologically again, thinking what that means is that self is somewhere in our connection, in our relatedness.
Brahman in Hinduism is, again, the hidden God without attributes. the ultimate Godhead in Hinduism. It's an aspect, Brahma is an aspect of Brahman that is visible or recognizable by human beings. So again, this is like Ein to Ein Sof. It's Brahman to Brahma. The Om, Joseph Campbell has a good description of Om, the sacred sound. Om is the word that represents to our ears the sound of the energy of the universe, of which all things are manifestation. You start in the back of the mouth, and he goes for this. And it's the idea that out of that silence, that Om is kind of surrounded by silence. It comes out of silence and it returns to silence. So Om is the manifestation that comes out of the silence. I'm going to skip the Atman and Maya for now, because those are a lengthy path. In Taoism, we have the Tao. Let's see. The dark beyond dark. According to Richard Wilhelm, who translated the I Ching, he also translated the Tao Te Ching. Tao has been variously translated as God, Way, Reason, and Logos. In point of fact, the term means little, since even for Lao Tzu himself, it was only a sort of algebraic symbol for something ineffable. It's a symbol of what can't be known. It's the dark beyond dark. And one of the major images in Taoism is the empty vessel. And the empty vessel is necessary. It's necessarily empty so that something can be filled. Without the empty space, nothing can happen. Nothing can happen without space, without emptiness. If you're full, you can't put anything in there. And then Wu Wei is the quality of being of the person to not strive. So that's the kenosis of the individual, where you don't try to force your will, but you try to be responsive to the need of the time. So you are not passive, but you are not active. Well, you flow. Perfect. Buddhism, we have shunyata, that's the emptiness, and out of the emptiness, shunyata is understood as it's emptiness, it's not a negation. Keiji Nishitani, who's a Buddhist philosopher, says the field of emptiness is nothing but the field of the great affirmation. And they talk about the fertile womb of emptiness. So it's this fertile womb out of which all comes. It's emptiness because you can't point to forms, but it's the emptiness that is full. It's the fertile womb. And it attests to the reality that everything does not find its own existence in itself, but rather is open to, dependent upon, and therefore able to contribute to what is other. And this gets to interdependent origination, which Thich Nhat Hanh, translates as interbeing. Interbeing or interdependent in origination. all things are interdependent, and we know things by knowing them in connection with other things. So this interbeing, we're not self-enclosed,
tightly packaged individuals. And then anatta is the concept of no self. And all of these different ways of understanding the ineffable, Joseph Campbell says, the absolutely unknowable can't be known, it can only be sensed. And this gets back to what we were talking about at the beginning. You can't know from a distance, you have to know through participation, through engagement. And so kenosis takes us into not about knowing, not about belief, not about what we can grasp, but to practice, to engage, to encounter. And so it's in the practice, it's in the participation with these different elements, whatever the way in that you use, where you get a sense. And Karen Armstrong talks about this. She says it's opposite to the scientific mindset, where you establish a principle and then you can act on it. You act and then you can know something about the transcendent to which you want to get access. You cannot get access to the transcendent unless you're participating in it, unless you're engaged in it in some way. I'm going to jump to Jung here. Let's finish up with Jung. Jung's psychology is mystagogic. Any transmission of knowledge is fundamentally mystagogic. It's an attempt to guide the reader or the listener towards an experience of something that can only be pointed at and never concretely described. So you don't tell someone about something and then they know it. You guide them and they have to have their own experience. In his book, The Idea of the Holy, Rudolf Otto, in one of his chapters, says, if you haven't had the religious experience that I'm going to talk about, I ask you to stop reading. Because you won't be able to understand it, and I cannot convey it in words. It has to be something that a person is initiated into. And Jung's psychology is mystagogic. So we move from what one writer calls the ontological dogmatic assertion to this mystagogic sense. It's not about the thingness or the beingness, but to try to elicit a response. And Jung's idea is that his psychology is about experience. And when he's writing about analysis, he's writing about his work with his clients, he says, it's impossible for me to explain what happens. It's impossible for me to give you a sense of what happens in analysis, because that would just be my putting empty words in the place of living realities. You have to have the experience. And then he says about dreams, to experience a dream and its interpretation is very different from having a tepid rehash set before you on paper. Everything about my psychology is, in the deepest sense, experience. The entire theory, even where it puts on the most abstract airs, is the direct outcome of something experienced. To enter the dream and experience it is where you understand it. It does not come from the text. It doesn't come from some clever interpretation. Unless you get it in a very experiential way, you won't get it. One of the things he says about the psyche, he calls it the densest darkness it is possible to imagine. We do not know what the psyche is. It is the densest darkness it is possible to imagine. All we can do
is experience it. But we don't know what it is because we are in it. We can't use the psyche to know the psyche. Your eye cannot look into your eye. It can't see it. It doesn't have that capacity. It needs a mirror. If you want to see into this eye, if you want this finger can't touch this finger. It's impossible to know. All we can do is be in it and be in the experience and to recognize that we are in the experience and that everything we are basically what he calls kind of trapped in the psyche. So we're having a psychological experience. And he says this much we do know beyond all doubt, that empirical reality has a transcendental background which at most can be grasped in hints. It's mystagogic. The unconscious are the unknown depths out of which consciousness arises. And he uses this image of the lotus that comes from these unknown depths. He talks about the unconscious as the primordial womb. There's shunyata, the womb of emptiness, the fountainhead of the psyche. And it comes from these, he uses the image of consciousness being like the lotus on the surface of the water with its roots stretching down into the dark depths. We don't know where our consciousness comes from. And when we look at our thoughts, we think we create them, but we encounter them. They happen to us. You're having a conversation with somebody and the right thing comes into your mind at that moment. Did you make the right thing or did you discover the right thing to say? And sometimes you don't discover it and there's just silence. And maybe that's the place you need to be in. What is coming to you? What is being presented to you? He talks about the importance of mythic language. Well, we've been talking about the Christian theology and gnosis. The reason that he goes to mythic language and religious language is that it brings us into the drama. A theory is abstract and distances us. He even talks about his own concepts. He says, I say animus, and all of those are veils on the unknowable. But I need to use them in order to talk about anything at all. I need to have concepts so we can talk about something that can't be talked about. So don't get hooked on anima and animus. Use them, engage with them, but the mythic language means that all of a sudden you're in the drama. Hate and love, fear and reverence enter the scene of the confrontation and raise it to a drama. It allows you to be engaged in it. So you experience, whatever your experience of God is, you are someone who feels comfortable with that idea, you hate God, it's not really the point to say yes or no. It's to be in the drama. It's to be in the dialogue. It's to be in the fight. If it's anger, then that's part of where that participation is. That's where you start. If it's love, that's where you start. One of the ways that I think about the difference between our sort of scientific and technical outlook and the religious outlook that Jung talks about is that in science we want to know. That's its purpose. The root of the word science is to know. The religious or the mystical is a discipline of not knowing. It's not grasping. It's not holding. And so Tolstoy says we can know only that we know nothing. That is the highest degree of human wisdom. And Yeats says, We can make our minds so still, like still water, the beings gather around us that they may see their own images and so live for a moment with a clearer, perhaps even fiercer life because of our quest.
That says our quiet.
Yeah, our quiet. Because of our quiet. You're right. And that probably is the proper quote. They live a fiercer life because of our quiet. So to hold that stillness, to not know, to enter into life experience. That's what the artist does. That's what the artist does. Deepens the experience of life. And allows us to deepen our own experience of life. This image is from a prayer book from the 1300s. And this is an image of Christ's wound. And there's the mandorla, and it's his wound in his side. I'm sorry, what?
It looks like a feminine.
It's like a yoni.
It looks like a yoni.
Absolutely.
Of course.
Right.
Feminine.
There's the feminine. And the wound is this, if we can be in that wounded place, it becomes generative, fertile. And it brings forth connection, relationship, understanding, compassion. And if we are able to, out of our suffering, let me play this. Out of our suffering, we can transform that into something that is meaningful, that is understandable, and that allows someone to live a fiercer existence because we've touched on something and they are not alone. This piece of music is from a composer named Goreshki. I've got it up here, so if you're interested in it, you can come and record that, write this down. It's from his Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. And the inspiration, well, where did the music go? There it is. The inspiration. Don't go away, music.
It gets quiet when you talk.
It's very thoughtful that way. Is a poem scratched on the wall of a Gestapo prison by an 18-year-old girl. And she wrote this. Mother, no, do not cry. Queen of heaven, most chaste, most chaste. Help me always. Hail Mary. In the midst of absolute meaninglessness and suffering and unbelievable horror, what makes a person reach out to something beyond them for meaning, for the divine, for something, for God, for the divine mother, the great goddess? And the composer takes that and translates it into a piece of art, and we listen to it, and we can connect to it in a way that we can take it in and be touched by what it means to be a human being. And that's transformative. That brings us in touch with something transcendent in our own experience. So by going deeper into our human experience and by communicating with each other and by sharing, and that's what we do in our work, that's what the artist does. So some monk in a cell in the 1300s writes something and I read it hundreds of years later and it saves my life. That's the healing, that's the transcendent. That's the transcendent that comes out of going deeply into the experience. And that something is seeded in the world. It's at that point there's nothing else that can be said about it. I'm going to let this play, and if there are any other questions or anything at all, we can finish up there. Thank you for being here today.